uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And every time Rush Limbaugh hears that theme music, he ups his meds. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Another beautiful day here in the United States of America. Canada, Mexico, North America, all over the planet. Hey, yeah, every day you're alive and breathing is a good day, right? I recalibrate your mind. I could complain, I suppose. Last night, the first night in our new house, the heat didn't work. So at 1 o'clock in the morning, we went back to a hotel. Because it was, yeah, you try sleeping when it's freezing and you're on an inflatable mattress that's the emergency thing to use until, you know, the movers come a week from now. And, oh, my. So here we are on 4 hours sleep and doing well. 7 minutes after the hour, it's Tom Hartman with you, where progressively, fiendishly plot for total world domination. Our number, 1-866-889-8894. Toll-free across the United States. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into the chat room, into our live chat room, and say hello. Always great to hear from you. And lots of stuff in today's news. And much of it is the kind of... I lack a word. I was going to say soft or eccentric. It's the kind of stuff, it's the kind of news that people look at it and they say, oh, that's not the big deal. And I have to say, you know, some of this actually really is the big deal. For example, economy shows sign of soft patch as oil rates weigh on consumers. Let me get back to that, actually, because I've got a couple others that go right with that. But the main thing, the number one thing, we are safe. You need no longer worry. Yes, the Bush administration, the TSA, and all that whole bunch, they have finally decided that they can no longer go along with the tobacco industry. No, we're not safe from secondhand smoke. No, we're not safe from our children being sold tobacco products. No, we're not. Now, what you'll recall, after 9/11, I still remember. In fact, I've been out here in Portland now for about a week, and I wanted to, you know, trim my mustache, right? I couldn't, right? Because the scissors that I used to carry with me, the back on right after 9/11, some guy going through he took out my scissors, he took out my nail clip, everything, it's gone. So it's like I've got to find a barber, right, or something like that, until our stuff gets here. Anyhow, so they said, okay, anything that you can use to bring down an airplane, you can't carry on board. Now, of course, this was before the cockpit doors were hardened. Obviously, weapons were on that list. Also, nail clippers. Lighters. Makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, you set on fire an airplane, it's going to be a problem. Go into the bathroom and set on fire something, or light up the seat in front of you, or for that matter, a butane lighter. I mean, there's enough fuel in a butane lighter to function as a small bomb. It might not blow the side of an airplane out, but it could sure create a whole heck of a lot of chaos. And in fact, if something were injected into that butane, you know, like a tear gas kind of compound, something like that, and it would become essentially a gas. You know, there's just all kinds of things that can be done with butane lighters. And no, I'm not giving terrorists information. You find this stuff all over the Internet. And so the TSA said butane lighters can't come on airplanes. This was like on 9/14, right? It wasn't the TSA back then. It was the FAA. And butane lighters can't come on airplanes. And so the tobacco industry goes and has a conversation with W, or with the folks thereof, you know, with the Bush administration, and says, hey, wait a minute. Our clients, our addicts, What do pushers call their customers? Our customers, I guess. Our customers, they can't use our product if they can't light it on fire. And so they have to have their lighters. I mean, you're talking about keeping away from people something that is absolutely essential to their survival. And so the Bush administration said, okay, we're going to allow butane lighters onto airplanes because the tobacco industry gives us so much money. And it was reported for like one day. There was this little story in the newspaper. I wrote a piece about it. Michael Moore actually wrote about it, I believe, in Stupid White Man. I could be wrong, but I know he wrote about it someplace. And the details and who got talked to when and where and all that kind of stuff. And so that's been the law right up until today. Today, here we are, Thursday, April 14th, 2005, 3 years after 9/11, and finally, no one can carry a bomb onto an airplane in the guise of a butane lighter. Well, no one has so far. I guess that's good news. Mark Peterson, a Sioux Falls, South Dakota appraiser, this in the article by Leslie Miller in the Associated Press today. He says, it's been 3.5 years since 9/11, and they finally figured it out? Yes. Well, see, actually, they figured it out a little before that. They figured it out before 9/11. They figured it out before 2000. They figured it out before 1990. They figured it out before 1980. 30 years ago. 30 years ago. The Federal Aviation Administration said, butane lighters cannot be put in checked bags. Why? Because in the past, some of them had exploded and caught cargo holds on fire. It actually happened. And they said, we don't want this to happen again. It's not a good plan. Well, okay, they finally figured out. So we're safe now. Isn't that great? You can, however, bring matches on the plane. So, it really is about the, you can turn a butane lighter into a weapon. It is possible to do that in a way that if you still looked at it, it would still look like a butane lighter. The most common method, as I said, by contaminating the contents of it. But in any case, so here we are. We are now safe. You can breathe a sigh of relief. And of course, this is the general insanity of the whole thing. I mean, here, it's like, which interest is at play? The major interest that's at play with this administration, with the Bush administration, the major interest that's at play is how scared can we, how much can we frighten people? How much nonsense can we spread? For example, I mean, all those years, it's been over 15 years now. Since the FDA proposed hardening cockpit doors and, seriously proposed, the government said, we've had all these airplanes. Now, this was back 20, 25 years ago. We had all these airplanes that were hijacked to Cuba. And they said, how can we stop these hijackings? It's a very easy method. You make it so that the cockpit door can't be kicked in. And you put a lock on it so you can't turn the handle and open it. Very simple. This is not rocket science. But the airlines sent their lobbyists to Capitol Hill. You see, just another example of the problem where the need to make money, which is a fine thing. God bless them, corporations, companies making money. I'm all in favor of it. However, when the need to make money starts to contaminate the public interest, it starts to contaminate what's good for we the people. It begins to contaminate rational public policy. Then not only do you have a problem, A, but B, you no longer have the kind of democratic republic that the founders envisioned of a government, to paraphrase Abe Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, of the people, for the people, and by the people, or by the people and for the people. You no longer have that. You have a government of, by, and for corporate interests or the interests of wealth. And that is exactly the kind of government that England had in 1776. And we said, we don't want this anymore. Speaking of the economy, the U.S. economy may be hitting a soft patch, right? Greg Ipp and John Hilsenroth. Great team of writers, by the way. I quote a lot of their stuff on this show. In today's Wall Street Journal, disappointing March retail sales, they note, along with slowing job growth. Could it be? Well, see, what happened was, to the extent that there was an economic recovery, just in time for the election by coincidence, It had nothing to do with Bushonomics. In fact, we have been, ever since Bush came into office and declared a new era of Bushonomics. Reaganomics is back. Supply-side economics is back. We're going to have that general insanity known as Bushonomics. As soon as he said that, the markets began to tank. No, the recession did not begin in 2000. It did not begin before Bill Clinton left office. It began when George Bush came in and made clear what his policies were going to be. March, April of 2001. I mean, go back and look at the numbers. And any rational person, any in the business field, in the markets, they all know, if you look back over the last 150 years, that under Democratic administrations, the stock market has gone up, and under Republican administrations, the stock market has gone down. Under Democratic administrations, wealth has been generated, the wealth of the United States has increased, and under Republican administrations, the wealth of the United States as a whole and the wealth of the middle class has decreased, and the wealth of a very small group of individuals and corporations has increased disproportionately. And it again, this is no secret. You can Google it. You can it's all over the place. Go to TomHartmann.com, go to the message boards. But there have been we've had several really great discussions on this over the last couple of years that people have that are archived on there. And just, you know, with all the detail, I'm not going to bore you with all the detail. Well, so they say, well, we had this recession or we had this recovery just in time for the election. Well, why was that? It was because Alan Greenspan was pumping the economy as hard as he could by driving interest rates down to levels we hadn't seen since the 1950s. Back when the dollar was worth a whole heck of a lot more than it is now. Back when we were recovering from World War II, we were trying to pay off our war debt. Back when the United States was growing like a weed. Our industrial production was growing like crazy. Back when the top marginal income tax rate was 90%. Back when entrepreneurs could start companies because the Sherman Antitrust Act was actually being enforced and huge corporate monopolies were not so powerful that they would squash like a bug any little person, any little company that came up with a new idea and said, hey, I've got a new way to do something. We'll just incorporate that into our browser. Back when it was possible to start a business in America. Back when a family business, if you owned the corner dry cleaner shop, or you owned the restaurant down the street, your little family business, and it was enough to, for the family to get by, and you could pass it along to your kids, and your kids could work there, and it was multi-generational wealth. It wasn't huge wealth, it wasn't Bush family kind of wealth, but it was multi-generational wealth. Now, all of that wiped out ever since Reagan stopped the enforcement of the Sherman Act and allowed corporations to merge, all the merger and acquisition mania. Which led to, of course, downsizing, getting rid of redundant employees, and the beginning of the end of the middle class of America. Well, it's continuing. I'll give you the rest of the details right after this. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
Well, I heard a minister the other day talking about the great injustice and evil of the men in white robes, the Ku Klux Klan that roamed the country in the South.
This is James Dobson.
They did great wrong to civil rights and to morality, and now we have black-robed men, and that's what you're talking about.
You gave them the old razzle.
Oh, yeah.
You razzled.
Oh, Mr. Dobbs, there's this whole movement. All these judges, they're accountable to nobody.
Lots of flash.
Excuse me, read the Constitution. They're supposed to be accountable to nobody.
Yeah, misdirected.
Amazing.
With 9/11 and Saddam Hussein.
Yes, James Dobson back at it.
Laid them both right to perfection.
And Mark Levin, author of Men in Black, How the Supreme Court is Destroying America, forward by Rush Limbaugh.
Let those blue states complain.
Yes. I'm not even... I've said it. What more do you need to say? I mean, these guys are... it's like they have no respect for the rule of law. They have no respect for the Constitution, or they don't understand it. I mean, it's got to be one or the other. Anyhow, it's enough righteous indignation there. I want to get back to this economy thing. Louise reminded me. I haven't mentioned the news of the day. I mean, you know, our personal news. First of all, with Higgins. Somebody asked about Higgins, our cat who is the rescue cat we rescued from. Actually, our son rescued him from his college dorm, and he's nuts. I mean, he's totally psychotic. He attacks everybody. He's big. Great big huge yellow cat, and the TSA guy thought he may have had a hidden gun on him or something. He's poking Higgins' belly, and Higgins is like, "I want to eat this guy." And so we're doing everything we can to keep him off the guy's face. Well, yesterday, we moved in sort of, and the other two cats, they're like, you know, new house, they're terrified, they're hiding in the closet. Higgins is stalking the house. He goes to the back window, the back door. There's a sliding glass door out on the back deck. And there's a couple of geese out there. Geese are big and loud, and they're honking. And every time they honk, the other two cats are like, they start trembling. And Higgins is like banging against the window trying to get at him. And one of the geese comes running at the window, and Higgins backs up a little bit for a minute. And then says, "Nah, that's okay. I can take you on." And when we lived in Vermont, we've had friends come over and bring a dog in a large dog. It's like a 40, 45-pound, 50-pound dog. Bring a dog in the house, and Higgins catch him as he's flying through the air, about to land on the head of this thing. So anyhow, Louise walks out on the deck, and the geese and the ducks run away, and then one of the geese, a gander, I guess, says, "This is my territory," and he comes back up, and he chases her back in the house. So she didn't totally run away. That and the other news of the day is that starting on Monday, I'm here. I've written all these books on attention deficit disorder. The bottom line is I'm easily bored. I love having a lot of things to do. Last year I published 3 new books. Right, the year before that, 2 new books. While doing a radio show, so we thought, hey, what the heck? A great opportunity came along, and so starting on Monday, myself and Heidi Stauber and Paul Pimentel will be doing a local morning program on a local radio station, local talk radio station here in Portland, before this program. So from 6 to 9 a.m. Pacific time, I'll be on KPOJ AM 620, from whose studios I'm broadcasting right at this moment, by the way, and doing that program. And they have a web stream on their website, which is 620kpoj.com. And then we'll be doing our program here. The Tom Hartman program on nationally. And people say, "Can you do that?" And I said, "Yeah, I don't think it'll be a problem at all." When I started out in radio, I mean, one of the things I did was morning drive, Drake format. So I know how to get up early in the morning. I always get up early in the morning. Anyway, I mean, usually when I write, I get up at 4 in the morning. I write until 5 or 6 or 7, so I can do a morning show. I hope. Now we're going to have a great time. Okay, we're going to get back to the economy right after this break. This is the Tom Hartman radio program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination.
Ever wonder who coined the phrase, "We eliminate the middleman"? Well, one thing's pretty certain. It wasn't the middleman. And how did they eliminate him? Something fishy there. But I digress. GEICO pioneered direct-to-consumer car insurance over 65 years ago, and they've been saving smart drivers money ever since. Give them a call, and you might ask them, what did they do with the middleman?
GEICO's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? GEICO, 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15%.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. I neglected to mention KPOJ's AM 620 here in Portland, Oregon, is also Portland's progressive talk station. And they, so It's a nice home. It's a nice home. It's a great radio town. There's other KBOO, the local community station is on. I was on there yesterday helping them with a fundraiser, and it's just a lot of great radio happening in this town. So for an old radio guy like me, this is a hoot. And somebody in the chat room asked him, "Am I going to continue writing books?" Yes, actually, I just submitted one to my agent. And we have an editor working on another, so hopefully we'll have two more books coming out. Well, they won't come out this year, but we're wrapping them up this year. And I actually do write them, unlike some other folks. I mean, I actually write my own books. So in answer to the questions in the chat room, if you want to drop into our chat room, by the way, TomHartmann.com will get you there. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And let's take a few phone calls here before we move along. John in Pennsylvania on the line. Hey, John, what's up? Louise, I'm trying to click this thing, and we haven't apparently assigned permission on this board to do it, so you're going to have to do it. There we go. John, you there? No, John's on hold. We gotta hang on just a minute here. I am going to go to options, change show. No, that's not it. Desktop director. Director, there we go. Now I should be able to do it, but I can't. Let's put that back on hold. Okay, let's see if Jay in Atlanta. Okay, Jay, I've got you. Are you there?
Yeah. Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Cool. See what happened, John. I just dumped John. I had the wrong button pushed. See, brand new board here. I'm learning this board, and I didn't have the line hot. I'm sorry.
Worked out my favor.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, Jay, what's up? And John should call. Give us a call back. We'll put you on the air right away. I'm sorry, Jay. Go ahead.
You mentioned the point about accountability.
Yeah.
I once was in my moments of fantasy. I thought we should all mail Bush a dictionary with that word highlighted. But
yeah, it wouldn't matter. I mean, Kennedy apologized for the Bay of Pigs. Clinton apologized for Mogadishu, or wherever it was there in Somalia where the Black Hawk went. You're never going to hear George Bush say, you're not even going to hear him make the excuses. You're not even going to hear him say, "Oh, gee, our intelligence was wrong," when of course the intelligence was just fine. It's the pieces of it that were cherry picked and stovepiped, and then handed off to poor Colin Powell so he could go out and make a fool of himself in front of the world.
Yeah, exactly. But facetiously speaking, you said something a couple of days ago I thought was so stupid when you asked, you rhetorically asked, are we just going to wait? Should we just wait for the next election, or should we invoke the RICO thing? And I was thinking, well, if they haven't crossed the line to deserve that, by now, when are they ever going to deserve it?
Yeah, really, if I asked the question that way, I should have said and, not or, because we should be doing both, and we shouldn't wait for the next election. We should be working toward it right now, getting active and getting organized, and I would love to see somebody out there talking about what can be done about this organized crime organization.
Well, the thing is, I went to the website of the guy you were talking to. He mentioned reopen911.org, and I just came back from looking at that, and not even some of the details were new to me, but the overall scope of what the message was not.
Yeah.
And the shock of that and everything else makes me say, wow, I guess they figured that they could just be right in our face with it, and they could get away with it. And I feel like, I guess we've proven them right, that they can get away with doing anything they want, and we can't stop them, no matter how much we talk about how much we need to stop them.
No, we haven't proven them right, and they can't get away with anything, no matter what. What we have found is that so far, with many things, they've been able to get away with things. But, the tide turns. I mean, that was true of Nixon for a while, too.
Duplicity is such a...
Yes, it's a whole other level. There is a mind-boggling level of corruption here. At least during the Nixon administration, there were some people. There was John Dean, who had respect for the rule of law. He was the special counsel to the president, and Nixon fired him instead of elevating him to attorney general like Bush did with his special counsel, who said, "Oh, whatever you do, sir, yes, enemy combatants, we can make up."
But they're
that
worried
word.
About appearances, right? But, they're worried about appearances.
Yes, they understand it's all about PR. I got that. They absolutely understand it's all about PR, and that ultimately, I think, is going to bite them in the butt. I'm telling you, people really are, Jay. People really are waking up around the United States, and it's not just because all of a sudden there's liberal talk radio. It is because they have stepped over the line. They have stepped over the line so many times. They have stepped over so many lines that you have Republicans who are in revolt against these guys.
Plus, for the sake of argument, Bush tomorrow was like seen on camera, even by every single individual. He didn't know the camera was there. And he said something so preposterous like, you know, boy, Condoleezza Rice is one dumb nigger. Just, you know, the most egregious thing that could ever come out of his mouth, they couldn't deny it. I still don't see how that would change anything. They would still say, well, we're in charge. What are you going to do about it? Yeah. Stephen Colbert made the best joke during the week of the Republican convention. He was summing up the upcoming themes of the week. Thursday night's theme for the Republican convention was going to be F.
Yeah, no, I got it. Jay, I'm sorry. I'm going to nuke you. It's a new studio. I didn't know where the kill button was. I wanted to dump that word, and it's not like, you know, it's FCC fine stuff, but it's let's just not do that. Let's just not do that. But if Bush said something really stupid, yeah. Actually, he has. I have clips of him saying things that are really stupid, but I'm not going to go to him right now. We have a few other callers here. John, was it John in Pennsylvania?
Yep, that's me.
Hey, John, sorry I dumped you there.
That's all right.
I'm learning my way through here. First time it's happened this week, actually, so that's pretty good.
Well, that's okay. Back to what you were saying before your first break, when you were talking about the historical degeneration of the economy, where we were 50 years ago, 30 years ago, then post-Reagan and everything like that.
Yeah.
All the indicators that point to things like that, how much less minimum wage is worth, the way the economy was structured, how much less corporate influence there was back then. It's like the white elephant in the living room. And
I know.
No one ever talks about it in the media. And
well, I talk about it just about every day, and increasingly people are. And you're starting to see now, particularly in the, quote, alternate media and on websites. For example, there's a piece by Molly Ivins up on Common Dreams today talking about this. And that's nationally syndicated in newspapers all over the country. You know, increasingly people are starting to say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on? They're realizing that, you know, the economy has fundamentally shifted. And it's fundamentally shifted in a profoundly negative way ever since Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, and the reason I called is lobbyists. We talk about them, we say how bad they are, but what I don't understand is, maybe I'm ignorant about this, what would happen if there were no lobbyists? I mean, it would hurt both sides, I guess, because I know that we also have lobbyists that are fighting for good things, but not with money, just with words, I guess, or like they're not buying influence like gas lobbies and energy lobbies. I mean, is there any way to get rid of lobbyists, or what would happen? You see, that's the one thing. I point it all to them. It seems like if you didn't have lobbyists,
yeah,
government would work.
The whole lobbyist thing, the explosion in lobbying, the $1 billion a year being spent in lobbying as opposed to just, you know, a little bit here and there historically. Because, I mean, you read Carl Sandburg's biography of Abraham Lincoln, and he said, there's a great quote in there, and if I'm doing this from memory, but I think it's pretty close. He was quoting Stanton, I believe, who was the Secretary of War. He said there was a steady line of fixers waiting to go in and, you know, cycling in and out of the White House, and now I'm no longer quoting, and it essentially made Abe Lincoln crazy. But he, you know, he knew that he had to deal with these people because they were the ones who were supplying him with war materiel. But you know, back in those days, it was called bribery and influencing, and it was against the law if there was quid pro quo and that sort of thing. In 1978, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations are persons, and they have First Amendment free speech rights, more or less, political speech rights, certainly, and because they don't have mouths, they speak with dollars. And so now we have a situation where $1 billion was spent in the last election cycle on advertising, on political advertising. Now, if the radio and television industry, and it's primarily television, but radio's in this too, but I'd say probably 80-90% of it is television. If that industry has discovered that by not giving politicians free time, they can make $1 billion every 4 years and $500 million every 2 years, do you think that they're going to start running news stories about election campaign reform?
Not unless they have to.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the genesis of the whole thing. It's the dog chasing its tail. These two problems are completely interrelated, and that is the fact that the way that we organize campaigns in the United States, the way that we have the Supreme Court, whatever, has allowed the free speech laws to allow corporations to become to do what was once a felony and called bribery and influencing, and then that, you know, and this dog chasing its tail. I believe, however, that reform can happen, John. And the reason why I believe that reform can happen is because the Supreme Court has reversed itself many, 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 many times over the years, and they always do it because the public pressure, public perception, public attitude changes. And I think the public attitude is going to change on this. John, I appreciate your call. I got to move along. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Liz in Philadelphia on the line. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi. I was moved by your housing dilemma to call in with some tangible evidence of what's happening in the economy here. I have two people and a bulldog living in my guest room right now.
Oh, my.
They've been here for a week and a half because they were evicted. And what seems to be happening around here is that middle-class people are being thrown out of their houses because there's not a lot to invest in the market. So people with extra money are buying up housing property. They jack up the rents. And the people who live there either have to come up with the extra money, or if they can't afford it, they get evicted.
Well, it's not just people with extra money. I mean, there are these real estate investment trusts, REITs or REITs or however they say it. And you know, it's an investment thing. Although I suspect that they're going to start going in the tank because the now Greenspan, the Fed yesterday, they admitted the things are out of control because of what Greenspan did to get Bush reelected. Now they're going to have to crank interest rates up farther and faster than we expected. And already here now, we're seeing another piece in the Wall Street Journal today. Demand for steel in U.S. slows. Prices fall 6 months in a row. Guess what, folks? Why? Well, because we're letting them make everything in China. But the Chinese aren't happy about that. In China now, they're having riots about this. Literally, villagers are taking over villages because their water has been polluted and their air is being polluted by the local factories. And so, it's like the Bush, I don't want to just say Bush policies, because it's Reagan, Bush Senior, Clinton with regard to the international stuff. He was pretty good domestically, but with regard to international trade policies, and Bush II here, Bush Jr., all four of these presidencies have basically been on the path of giving America away to other nations, giving our economy away to other nations, and making sure that the well-born and well-bred, as Thomas Jefferson referred to them, are the first and only protected. And, Liz, 30 years ago, the majority of occupants of shelters for homeless people, and 30 years ago, they were fairly rare before Reagan, opened all the mental hospitals and suddenly we had homelessness in America. But 30 years ago, the majority of people were single men who were 50 years ago were referred to as hobos or bums. And many of them simply chose that as a rather nomadic lifestyle. Many of them were just poor or broke, or a lot of them schizophrenic, whatever. Now, today, the majority of people who are seeking emergency housing are families.
Yeah, I well remember that from the Reagan era. I've lived here a long time, and I remember families on the street, and I'm starting to see the return of those conditions. We have people living in Rittenhouse Square. We have... If you go down to the Federal Reserve Building during the Reagan era and straight through the Bush era, hundreds of people would sleep under the eaves because it was well lit and a little bit warm.
Yeah.
And we're starting to see that again all over the city.
Yeah. So, it's grim. Liz, thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks.
Great to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Alan in New York on the line. Hey, Alan.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I've got a couple of questions around the same topic. Let me just fire them off here. Are you an isolationist? Were you opposed to the invasion of Afghanistan? Don't you think it would have been better handled as a international crime by international
Am I being interviewed by a newspaper here, Alan?
I just wanted to... I think I am an isolationist. I'm trying to develop my ideas about this.
Okay, well, let's take that first, because each of these are fairly large topics. I agree with George Washington that we should avoid foreign entanglements whenever possible. I don't know enough about the history of World War I to know whether I would have thought that we should have gone into it. I do think we should have gone into World War II. But I think that we need to, that literally and truly, war needs to be the thing of last resort.
What about Afghanistan?
When the Taliban offered to give up Osama bin Laden, I think we should have taken him. I mean, that was the deal. We should have taken him. They said, we'll give you Osama bin Laden. We'll shut down the camps. We don't need al-Qaeda here. Tens of thousands of people died as a result of our invasion of Afghanistan. Well, it's free now. Well, sort of. I mean, you've got, you know, two UNICAL executives running the country now, and yes, UNICAL is building their pipeline now, but, you know, is and arguably that's in the best interest of the United States if we're going to say that our economy is forever going to be dependent upon oil. But, you know, I really think that when the Taliban said, hey, you want Osama, we'll give him to you. There, if we're going to go around the world taking out third world governments that are repressive and horrible, there is no shortage of them. There's like 100 of them. That is not our job.
They offered us Osama, and we wouldn't have had to send troops in?
That's right. They offered Osama. They said they wouldn't give him to the United States. They would give him to some third nation where he would get a fair trial.
Oh, that's right.
And we said no. We're not going to go along with that. We're not even going to talk about it. You know, it's given to us or nothing.
And so you are opposed to our invasion?
Yeah, broadly. I'm you know. Yeah, sure.
All right. Well, thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And we'll pick up a couple other calls after this break, but there's the music, the world-famous music. I got to say that this demand for steel, this really concerns me. The fact that we're seeing the six straight months in a row now, Nucor Corp, U.S. Steel Corp, Mattel Steel, they're all laying off people. It's like, this is not a good sign for the future of America. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Here's my take on the whole Afghanistan thing. The people who attacked us on 9/11 were not a nation. It wasn't Afghanistan who attacked us. It was actually 15 Saudis and a Yemeni and a whatever, you know, with box cutters and whatnot. It wasn't a nation. It was a criminal enterprise and a relatively small one at that. And George Bush or any president of the United States, we could have done the same thing with these guys that we did with Timothy McVeigh and his buddies. I mean, Bill Clinton faced a terrorist bombing in the United States that killed hundreds of people instead of thousands. But, you know, the scale was slightly different, but it was relatively the same thing. And what he said was, hey, this guy's a criminal. We'll track him down. We'll put him in jail. And in Italy, Aldo Moro, the prime minister, the head of the country, was murdered by terrorists. Right, by the Red Brigades. And what did the Italians say? Oh, we're going to invade some other country because they're giving them... No, come on. These guys are criminals. You deal with them as if they're criminals. If we had simply said Osama bin Laden and these guys, the whole world was with us. Don't you remember? They were marching in Tehran on our behalf. France, Le Monde, we are all Americans now, the big headline. If we had simply said these guys are psychopathic criminals, the rest of the world, help us, arrest them and put them in prison, that would have been it. We didn't need a war, but George needed a war. George needed a war because he was an illegitimate president and because he thinks war is cool because he's never been in one. 1-866-889-8894, Sean in Virginia on the line. Hey, Sean, what's up?
I was asking about Scott Ritter's interview.
The one on this program a few months ago or the ones that he's been recently doing? Actually, he was on this program a couple of weeks ago, too. But I know in the last couple of days on a couple of other stations, he's been on the air and he's been talking about how the administration has been inviting him to participate in helping them gin up a war in Iran. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I just heard something about it yesterday, and I'm surprised that they would invite him to do anything.
Yeah, we'll have to get Scott on. I mean, you know, Scott's a friend of this show, and he's been on a number of times, and we have his phone number. We'll track him down, and one day next week we'll get him on, and we'll hear what he has to say about this. I'm surprised that at the highest level anybody would be contacting him, but it wouldn't surprise me at all that, you know, at some middle or lower level somebody might be trying to bring him in, or for that matter, trying to offer him a little incentive. You know, whether the little incentive is the kind of, oh, you want to keep your house? Or if it's the, hey, how'd you like a $250,000, you know? Or whatever. I mean, who knows? I'll have to ask him.
Well, do you know what the basics are of what he's been saying these past few interviews?
Only vaguely. So I'd rather have him speak to that than me. Sean, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I do appreciate it. We will get back into that as days go by. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, sometimes there are things that you think you know and then you don't know. Sometimes there are things you don't know that you don't know. Sometimes there are things that you don't know that you didn't need to know that you do need to know that you don't know that you need to know. Sometimes there are things that you're not even sure that you want to know. And this may fall into that category. This is just a little quickie for our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. And think that you're out of your mind.
Everything You Know Is Wrong.
Yes, Quentin Miller, Wheeler and Kelly Miller, entomologists at Cornell University. I remember one of my first college professors was a professor of entomology who was teaching a class in biology. And if you said bugs around this guy, he would go absolutely nuts. Absolutely nuts. They're insects. They're not bugs. Anyhow, a couple of entomologists, Quentin Wheeler and Kelly Miller, have discovered 65 new species of slime mold beetles. Now, these are rather, how do you say it, odd insects. They're beetles. They have hard, you know, the hard shells and like that. They're quite small. 65 new species, and they live on slime mold. Mold that forms, you know, a slimy surface. Like, you know, you go out in the forest and that slimy stuff on dead trees and things. That's slime mold. So these are beetles that live on that slime mold. And, of course, if you discover a new beetle or a new anything, if you're a real live entomologist or a real live taxonomist, you get to name it. And so we now have two new slime mold beetles named after, guess who? George Bush and Dick Cheney. Yes, indeed. The Agathidium bushy Miller and Wheeler, and the Agathidium chenei Miller and Wheeler, and let us not forget the Agathidium rumsfeldi Miller and Wheeler. Rumsfeld got one too, not to be left out. There you go. I'm sure you wanted to know, all
that
about
wrong,
that.
But you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. And think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, what a great little story. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. The benchmark steel prices in the U.S. have declined. Now, I keep coming back to this, and the reason I keep coming back to it is I want to finish this thread for just a moment, and then I'm going to go to the phones and like that, but I just want to get this out and down. I mean, this is really something. Confounding this, Paul Glader in today's Wall Street Journal, confounding, how do you pronounce that? Earlier forecasts for continued high steel prices, I guess it depends on whether you're British or American, demand for steel in the U.S. is beginning to slow, weakening prices and prompting steelmakers to cut back production. Benchmark steel prices in the U.S. have declined for six straight months and don't appear to be rising the second quarter. They point out last week International Steel Group temporarily idled operations in Cleveland. That was just 11 months after opening the furnace. See, everybody thought that that little boost that we got from Rumsfeld driving interest rates down into the floor to get George Bush reelected, that that was like some kind of real recovery, that maybe it had something to do with tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. Did I say Rumsfeld? I meant Greenspan. Thank you. Thank you, Louise. Yes, Alan Greenspan, I'm thinking of the Rumsfeld Beetle here, is what it is. Greenspan drove interest rates down to try and get the economy back. What, you think when you give tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires that they actually say, gee, I've got an extra $5 billion in my checking account. I think I'll go out and hire somebody. I think I'll create a factory. No, people create factories. People build businesses because they perceive there's a need for a product. If you see an opportunity in a marketplace and you have the ability to fill that opportunity, if you see demand in the marketplace and you have the opportunity to fill that, then you have a business opportunity. And you do it. And that's, you know, that's what you do. But if you don't do it just because you have money in your pocket, nobody. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever. And in fact, we saw it during the Reagan recession. We saw it, and Reagan ended up having to raise taxes 6 out of his 8 years because of his first disastrous tax cut. And Bush, too, had to raise taxes. They took us so far away from the standards that Eisenhower had and that Kennedy had. They just took us in such extreme, and even Nixon and Johnson and Carter, they took us in such an extreme direction and just, you know, essentially wiped out our economy. And people thought, just, you know, for a month before the election, gee, I guess those tax cuts for the rich people are helping out the economy. No, it was Alan Greenspan, the guy who was initiated into Ayn Rand's cult of objectivism. The ultimate, you know, the precursors to the libertarians in her apartment in, what, 1956 or something in New York City. It was Alan Greenspan, partisan hack, setting it up, you know, trying to make the economy decent so George could get reelected. U.S. steel executives thought they would spring back starting in the second quarter, notes the Wall Street Journal, of 2005, because they expected imports to drop and the U.S. economy to remain strong enough to consume inventory. Now, what this is about, they expected imports to drop because they thought that maybe the dollar would stop falling. That the dollar would continue to fall and that therefore the euro would continue to rise. And they thought perhaps some of the Asian currencies, like the yen, might actually start to rise. See, the Japanese have been propping up the yen by buying dollars like crazy. And what do they do with these dollars that they buy? They got all these dollars that they've bought to keep the yen from falling. And so they have to buy something, so they buy treasuries. They buy our debt. And this is the only way that George Bush has been able to finance his government, our government. We've gone from before Reagan being the biggest creditor, the wealthiest nation in the world, to now after Reagan, Bush, and Bush being the most impoverished nation in the world. We are the world's largest debtor. And who buys our debt? Well, you know, the Japanese have been buying it to prop up the yen. The Chinese have been buying it because essentially what they're doing by buying dollars from us and then putting them into treasuries, they are funding the transfer of jobs from the United States to China. And this is all just fine with the Bush administration. The Bush administration basically is the trust fund bunch. These are people who were born with trust funds. They were, you know, Ann Richardson or Molly Ivins said, George W. Bush was born with a silver spoon. He was born on third base and thought he hit a triple. And it was Ann Richardson who said George Sr. was born in a silver foot in his mouth. And you know, there's their concern about the average working person, the real economy. Nah. Only appearances. Make it look good so we can get reelected, please. Spot prices of hot rolled coil, a key benchmark product used to make autos and washing machines, have dropped 20%. Price of steel is dropping because demand is dropping. Now, does that mean if we give tax cuts to a few billionaires, they'll open a steel mill? I don't think so. although George continues to want to give more tax cuts to billionaires. Although in China, the price, $515 a ton, remains level with fourth quarter prices. See, China is making steel, and they're using it to make things, which they then ship to us. Peter McManus, a partner in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey-based World Steel Dynamics, predicts further declines, with the world export price for hot rolled coil dropping 22% by the third quarter of this year, he's saying. Steel production in the U.S. has dropped by nearly 10% in the last year. Yes, the economy hitting a bit of a soft patch. Well, what are we going to do about this? Nothing. Nothing. I mean, the Bush administration, their answer, to beg the Chinese to let the yuan, their currency, the renminbi, to let the yuan, the Chinese currency, increase in value because they have a peg to the dollar. And the Chinese are saying, don't think so. Because then what's going to happen is their currency will become more expensive. All the stuff in Walmart will become more expensive. So therefore, there'll be fewer imports into the United States. Now, Walmart, of course, doesn't want this to happen either. And most companies that import from China wouldn't, it's no problem. I mean, it's great for the company. This may not be all that good for America, but it's great for the corporation. Anyhow, so what are the Bushies doing about it? Now, just figure out some way to make it look good every time an election comes around. That's all they care about. And now we've got this energy bill on the House, the House Resources Committee. Approved, this from today's Wall Street Journal, approved drilling for oil in Alaska's Arctic Wildlife Refuge by 33-13, what they call the Set America Free Act. Yes, there's enough oil up there to supply this country for about 6 months. That's going to set us free. Jimmy Carter told us how to do it. He said it's really simple. It's a 20-year plan. You build alternative energy sources. The United States has no shortage of sunlight. In fact, we have so much of it in the South that we're burning enormous amounts of oil to try and keep it out of our buildings to air condition them. We have no shortage of sunlight. We can convert that into electricity. We have no shortage of wind. It's blowing all across the central states. It's blowing all across the Rockies. We could power the entire United States. Current technology. We could power the entire United States using just solar and wind. And that's not even getting into exotic stuff like geothermal, like they're using in Iceland, where they're building a hydrogen economy based on the fact that they've got, they have heat in the ground. They drill down, pull out some of that heat from those bubbling volcanoes. Maybe they'll do that at Mount St. Helens here. Maybe they shouldn't. I don't know. But stronger Republican majorities in Congress this year, as well as growing public awareness of the increasing cost of imported oil, could give President Bush his long-sought legislated energy policy, writes John Fialka in today's Wall Street Journal. The House Energy and Conference Committee rejected in a 31-20 vote a Democratic-led, I would say, attempt to remove a partial waiver for liability and damage suits brought against major oil companies and other manufacturers of the gasoline additive MTBE. Now, this isn't just you and I getting harmed by MTBE. It's like cities all across America are being harmed by MTBE. The nation's mayors, county officials, and water agencies oppose the liability waiver. But Congressman Joe Barton, Republican of Texas, rallied Republicans. So if Bush has his way, even our towns and cities won't be able to say, hey, stop polluting our water, please. No, the oil industry will reign. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just because we get around.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And Chuck in New Mexico, Scott in California, Alan in North Carolina, Ed in Kansas, and Tom, I'm not sure where you are. We will get to your calls right after this. First, I want to ask Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service to give us our report from Washington, D.C. for the day. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hello. You'd be interested to know that, of course, George Bush is going to throw out the first ball at the game in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
Tonight, the Washington Nationals. But you know what's so interesting? Look, I can't get a question in because I'm too liberal. He won't meet with us. Won't give myself or even April Ryan an interview, but he's meeting with the sports writers today.
Yeah, well, you know, he knows where his priorities are. Hey, Ellen, in the chat room, a couple of folks have pointed out that Jose Padilla is scheduled, or was scheduled sometime back, to be released today. Have you heard any word about that in Washington, D.C.?
No, I mean, we haven't heard a thing about it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either.
It's not going to happen. A couple other interesting things. First of all, Senator Kerry, along with the good Senator Lautenberg, have introduced they actually got a letter, and they got Senator Stevens to agree to this, who is actually the committee chair. They now want any video news releases or radio spots to have a disclaimer, not just at the beginning of the story that are released by the government, but throughout the story.
Oh, interesting.
So Ted Stevens has agreed to have hearings about that. So that'll be pretty interesting. Also, the House Democrats have urged, along with apparently 44 Republicans who wrote to Chairman Nussel in the House, to stop any Medicaid cuts from the overall budget resolution that is not supposedly that's not done. It's supposed to be done by April 15th, but they didn't meet the deadline.
Yeah.
And that's interesting that they got 44 Democrats to agree on that front.
Yeah, the Democrats are starting to wake up and get a spine here.
Well, it's taken them a long time.
Yeah.
Also, the White House is apparently now trying to, over the summer, look to the House and Senate Conference Committee in terms of trying to get private accounts put into a conference report on one of the overall spending bills. And this would be avoiding then, you know, because those are done by up or down votes, that would then avoid a whole discussion and debate about private accounts on the House or Senate floor.
Wait a minute. I don't understand the technicalities. Explain that to me.
Essentially, if you put a separate bill up and saying let's do private accounts, then the bill has to go through committee.
Oh, and you get to discuss it.
You get to discuss it. If it just added, like a lot of pork is, to what's called a conference report, that's when the same bill is passed by the House and Senate, and then they just add it on to a bill, those bills don't get debated. There's an up or down vote on conference reports.
Uh-huh.
So this is a way that they could avoid discussion about whether they should have private accounts. It just gets added to a bill, and it either goes or doesn't go.
For Social Security.
That's right.
Like a fiat accompli. I mean, they're just going to toss it in there.
Exactly. And it seems from my sources that that's what they're planning on doing.
That's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. Hey, Ellen, we have a caller here, Rachel in Santa Fe, who has a question for you real quickly. We only have about a minute left. Rachel?
Ellen Ratner, this is Rachel in Santa Fe. Valerie Espinoza is a great county clerk. Thank you for endorsing her last election.
Oh, you know what, Rachel? I just dropped Ellen. I'm just learning this new phone system, and what can I say? I just dumped Ellen when I put you on. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, Valerie Espinoza, our county clerk, is Ellen's sister-in-law, I believe.
Yeah.
And she is doing a righteously good job as a county clerk. She's really cleaning up some of the messes that we had during the last election.
That's great. So you have wonderful things to say about a relative of Ellen. And Ellen, I'm sorry I dumped you. We're out of time. And I still, with this new phone system here, I don't know how to do conference calls. I'm going to learn during the break. But thanks a lot, Rachel.
Thank you so much,
Ellen, with the Talk Radio News Service. It's a Tom Hartman radio program, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Missouri friends, you have to get involved. You got to participate. You got to write letters to the editors of the newspaper. You've got to call talk shows. You've got to write letters. You got to call or write letters to the editors of your local news, radio, and television stations. Contact the networks. Let PBS know that you're not happy about the fact that there's a right-wing coup trying to take over the public broadcasting system. And perhaps most important, let your elected officials know, particularly your local elected officials, your member of the State House of Representatives, your members of the State Senate, your members of City Council. Talk to the people on the school board. I mean, get to know these folks. Show up for the meetings. And then finally, although, you know, it's something that you should, like, schedule every week to do, call a member of Congress. Just, you know, it's 5 minutes out of your week. Call a member of Congress. They even have a toll-free number, 1-877-SOB-USOB. SOB, the letter U, SOB. It actually stands for Senate Office Building, United States Senate Office Building. But you can think of it as whatever you want. You know, it's 1-877-SOB-USOB. The energy bill, I just want to wrap this up, and then we're going to take a few phone calls here. The energy bill that just passed out of the House Resources Committee, is the Republicans are moving this thing along. This is the legislation that came out of Dick Cheney's secret meetings in 2001 when he was supposed to be chairing the Counterterrorism Task Force. Remember that? He was supposed to be the chairman of the Counterterrorism Task Force, and it never met until 9/11. But instead, he was busily doing his other job, which was being the chairman of the Energy Task Force. And they were busily meeting, but only in secret locations with industry moguls like Ken Lay. And they crafted this marvelous piece of legislation that would give billions of dollars of our money as gifts and incentives to the oil, gas, and nuclear industry. Threw a small bone, you know, a few million bucks to the solar and wind folks so that they wouldn't raise too many screams. But, I mean, it was just the smallest of bones. And now it's becoming legislation. It's working its way through the House. They just fought back an attempt by the Democrats to allow the nation's mayors and water officials to sue companies that have polluted their water with MTBE. Well, this is a billion-dollar problem. As John Fiella writes in the Wall Street Journal, the cost of the cleanup could run into the billions of dollars because the hypersoluble additive, when leaked from gasoline tanks, makes groundwater undrinkable. Some 29 states have reported serious problems. But Congressman Barton of Texas, one of Tom DeLay's hand puppets, sock puppets, Congressman Barton of Texas and other oil state members on the committee contend that it's unfair to charge manufacturers with the damage. They just put the stuff there. There's no reason to charge them with the damage. Well, who's going to pay for cleaning it up? I mean, you have to clean it up or we won't have water to drink and you're going to have, you know, childhood cancers or what, neurological debt. What? Well, the Republicans in Congress have a solution for that. Representative Barton, one of DeLay's hand puppets, he says, and I quote,
"We're receptive to putting additional funding into remediation efforts."
In other words, we're not going to have industry pay for this cleanup. We're going to have the taxpayers of America pay for this cleanup. We would not have our buddies in the oil industry pay. Are you kidding? The Energy Committee also approved a measure that would hold up new Environmental Protection Agency. The Energy Committee also approved a measure that could hold up new EPA rules that would reduce smog in major cities. The measure would allow the EPA to delay local efforts to reduce pollution for as long as a decade. So now the EPA can come in and say, no, you have to have more pollution. The Environmental Protection Agency has become the Bush Pollution Agency. or will, if this legislation passes, as these guys want. My. Let's go to the phone lines. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Scott in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, good morning. I wanted to get back to your earlier topic of slime mold.
Yeah, slime mold beetles.
Yeah. Yesterday, while the president/action figure, George W. Bush, was down addressing troops in Fort Hood, Texas, his Republican cronies in the Senate were busy voting down a $1.8 billion amendment to the emergency appropriations bill for Iraq and Afghanistan. The $1.8 billion was for veterans' health and mental services when they return.
Right.
We're going to have probably 100,000 or more of these veterans coming home who are going to have post-traumatic stress syndrome and who knows what else. They're not going to have any jobs to go to. That will probably sound familiar to your Vietnam veteran listeners. This just seems like a total no-brainer.
And this is also, it was also, pardon my interrupting you, Scott, but this was the most underreported story in the news. I mean, period. Just like nobody talked about it. It's as if it didn't happen. You know, Bush is doing his action. I'm an action figure out here with the troops. Yes, yes, support the troops.
Absolutely.
Put a yellow sticker on your car. But appropriate $1 billion for the troops when they come home. Sorry, we've got to worry about tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires.
Absolutely.
Really do. I mean, that's the important thing.
I would just say to those of your listeners in red states, to call their members of Congress and their senators and just express extreme outrage, because here we have half a country with, you know, support the troops stickers, which cost $3 at a drugstore, but we can't afford to pay these guys and take care of them when they come home.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And although, Scott, I think that we need to start calling them purple states, the whole United States, because there is not a state in this country where John Kerry didn't get a whole awful lot of votes. And
absolutely.
And in fact, where on the local levels, in a lot of these states like Montana and whatnot, you're seeing Democrats just really rising up and taking power. And,
absolutely.
And so it's like this whole idea of red states, blue states is more of the Bushies divide and conquer rhetoric. And I'm not going to have it. I mean,
absolutely.
No offense to you, but this is we're all purple here, just like Barney. You know, it's a. and wait till James Dobson gets a hold of that, right? Yeah,
listen,
there you go. I was waiting for James Dobson to come after Frazier. I kept going, why isn't he going after Frazier? If he's going, you know, metrosexual, if he can spot a latent homosexuality in SpongeBob SquarePants, pardon the digression. I'm sorry, but
saw
an old repeat last night on TV, and it was.
Not
anyhow,
at all.
As you were saying, Scott,
I would just say to everybody, it's so empowering a feeling to call your senators,
yes,
and your representatives and tell them what you think about this ridiculous stuff. And you know, the Democrats are starting to finally get a backbone between Barbara Boxer and Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah.
You know, just tell them to keep it up. We can't allow this to go on in our country.
Yeah, and don't hesitate, by the way, when you call 1-877-SOB-USOB to ask for Barbara Boxer's office or Nancy Pelosi's office and just say, hey, you know, I'm Tom in Portland, and I want to thank you for what you're doing. You're not my representative, but because you play a national leadership role in the party and in Congress, in a way you are my representative, and I want to thank you because you're doing a marvelous job.
I called Joe Biden last week and Senator Rockefeller, who said he was going to oppose Bolton. I mean, if we make enough noise, they cannot ignore us.
There you go. Well said. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Ed in Kansas on the line. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm great. What's on your mind?
I called you yesterday, actually, and I was talking about we can't keep calling these conservatives, or we've been calling them conservatives. We can't call them conservatives anymore. These are the reds.
The reds. Well, here's the problem, Ed. I know that you think of yourself as a conservative, and you would like to keep that label intact, and you're trying to hold on to it because it has.
Well, you have to be
had
a conservative. You have to preserve something.
Well,
and that's what I want to preserve, and so do you.
No. Hang on just a second here, Ed. Words have the meaning that everybody agrees they have the meaning of. For example, in 1776, the word privacy meant to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
You know, now it means something different. So, you know, the meaning of words changes over time. The cons, you know, Frank Luntz and his focus grouping and stuff, they decided, hey, let's make liberal a dirty word. And liberal was always thought of as a good word. George Washington said, you know, I hope to always see America as the foremost among nations in liberality. Liberal was came out of the Renaissance. But so they made that a dirty word. Well, what they are doing now, Ed, is they are making conservative. They have redefined the meaning of conservative, and I'm going to use their meaning. I'm going to continue using the word because they're using it. You know, I'm sorry. Yeah, I think that honest conservatives like yourself, or people who in the 50s, you know, Eisenhower conservatives, Dirksen conservatives, Goldwater conservatives, you know, honest conservatives like yourself are going to have to come up with a new word because these guys have stolen it from you. They've already done it. It's a done deal.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd like to call them Reds.
Yeah, well, and I agree with you, and I'm going to steal it. I'm going to do that from time to time. But I think it's
in the middle of Kansas. You know, this is Redland here. I mean, there's nothing too much purple about Kansas. We just had an election on the 5th.
I know, but
the gay ordinance on the ballot, it won by 72%. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And signs for that measure were posted in front of every church, and there's a church on every block here.
Yeah. Well, which isn't a bad thing. But the point is that, you know, every time one of these cons, these new cons, let's say, you know, some
cons
folks refer,
I like.
Yeah, okay, some folks refer to them as neocons, but that's really a whole different thing. But
no.
Every time one of these new cons appears on TV, you get people like Cliff May, you know, the Center for Preservation of Democracies or whatever. I mean, the guy is just, he's a toxic right-wing extremist. He's what you would call a red and what I would call a con. But they're always introduced as conservatives. And so I want to make sure that the listeners of this program, and particularly, you know, the people who just tune in occasionally, you know, they tune in across the dial and they hear that they get it, that's what these folks are, that this is what they're about, and so that there's no confusion.
Yeah. I like to call them banana Republicans, too. I think that's another good name for them.
Yeah, it is. It is. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Chuck in Los Alamos, New Mexico on the line. Hey, Chuck.
Hey, Tom. Hey, listen, I'd like to just go back to something you were talking just before the bottom of the hour.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to me that there's some other economic wars on the planet that I think we need to pay attention to, and one of them is Japan versus China.
Yeah.
You've seen about this energy drilling and what have you, and there's like this huge tension. And
particularly over the possibility of oil in the sea there between the two of them.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And and, you know, from the China side, they're saying that Japan needs to apologize for some new textbooks, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, the bottom line is that we do not have, I do not think, and I hope that you'll correct me if I'm wrong, we do not have a State Department that is capable of mediating here.
No, in fact, it gets worse than that. Let me just share with you very quickly, Chuck, from today's Wall Street Journal. The headline, Rice Plays Down Iran-North Korea Nuclear Threats. And I'm not digressing from your Japan-China issue here, because the bottom line of all of this is that Condi Rice is relying on China for everything.
Yep.
The communists, right? That this dictatorship that has killed millions of its own people, that continues to, that imprisons people for trying to create a labor union. Well, anyhow, the Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said the U.S. will decide this summer whether to pursue a tougher stance on Iran's nuclear program from the United Nations Security Council, but at the same time played down the immediate urgency of the nuclear threats from both Iran and North Korea. And basically she says, oh, North Korea, I'll give you the exact quote. This is from an article by Neil King and Carly Ann Robbins in today's journal. Ms. Rice dismissed as a bid for attention North Korea's recent declaration that it has nuclear weapons and its decision to walk away from multi-party talks on eliminating its nuclear program. I'm sorry, if one of my neighbors said, hey, I've got a nuclear weapon and I'm pointing at you, I would pay attention to them. I wouldn't say, oh, he just wants attention. You know,
I got to tell you, Tom, it's interesting because it's obvious that this playing card, they said in the BBC this morning that it's only 8 weeks,
yeah.
8 weeks of energy.
Yeah. You're talking about Anwar?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This sentence just makes it absolutely, this again from the Wall Street Journal. Ms. Rice made clear that the U.S. is still depending on China to persuade the North Koreans to return to the so-called six-party talks. And the Chinese assured her that they would do so during her visit to Beijing last month. Yes, the Chinese, they're always operating in our interest. They are our strategic partners. They are our good friends. We should just always trust everything they say. After all, they make all the goods we buy, don't they?
Well, you know, that's exactly it. And I got to tell you, Tom, I mean, I lived through Vietnam. I'm a veteran, and this is the first time in the last 30 years I've actually been scared for my family.
Yeah.
I think that we're getting to the point where these neocons are so psychotic that they may well destabilize everything.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, Chuck, they live in an absolute fantasy world. I mean, they're coming out of this place of ideology, and the reality is what's good for multinational corporations is good for the Bush administration, and that's their mantra. And having a strong relationship with China, regardless of the human rights implications, regardless of the implications to the U.S. economy, regardless of worker protections, regardless of the environment, regardless ultimately even of the impact that it may have on our relationship, our trading relationship with Japan and many other countries, is of primary importance, because China makes so much money for Walmart and so many other American corporations who fund the Bush administration. I mean, it's just off the world, off the wall. Chuck, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. We're out of time here in this segment. Ms. Rice said the discussions over how to deal with such nations as Iran are getting delicate. Yeah. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We were born before the wind, also younger than the sun. Yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sail into the mystic.
Welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. I'm Tom Hartman. 5 minutes before the hour. Start another sentence, Hartman. Okay, here we go. It's just sometimes it is so amazing that it leaves me almost speechless. I want to say, did you see this? Can you believe this? This is incredible. You'll recall during the election campaign. Remember that? You know, like September, October, November. Last year, during the election campaign, John Kerry said, the Europeans are negotiating with Iran. Everybody's worried about Iran. Iran has a very sophisticated and well-developed, far down the road, domestic nuclear power generation plant. A system, not just a plant. There's several of them. And that it's been built in part by a couple of European countries. They're getting some of their uranium from Russia. It's not just one country. And the question, of course, is why? And the answer that the Iranians say, you know, why, since they're sitting on 10% of the world's oil, why do they need nuclear power? Well, they say they want nuclear power because, in their opinion, the oil isn't going to last forever. And they can sell the oil and make a lot of money. And they can generate nuclear power, if it's a state-owned utility, relatively cheaply, and, you know, and it doesn't pollute the air and all this, you know. They haven't quite figured out the downside of nuclear power, apparently. But in any case, John Kerry said, you know, the Europeans have cut a deal with the Iranians where they will continue to do trade with Iran, because Iran buys a lot of stuff from Europe. I mean, everything from TV sets to machine tools to consumer goods to food. Europe will continue to sell things to Iran if Iran will agree to a certain level of inspections and assent that they are not building nuclear weapons, that they're just going to use this for peaceful purposes. And Cheney made fun of it. Cheney derided it. And then Bush made fun of it. And the whole Bush campaign was, how could John Kerry be so naive as to take the word of the French and the Iranians? And now, in today's Wall Street Journal, on Iran, Ms. Rice said the U.S. still has faith in European-led negotiations aimed at ensuring that Tehran's nuclear program remains strictly non-military and that what matters most is the unity of purpose among all the nations involved. Ain't it amazing? I mean, Bush, he adopted Kerry's policy on Iraq. It's like you could just go right on down the list. And then they claim, this is our idea. Yeah. Yeah.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here on the True People's Radio. Yes, indeed, the place where smart people get their news. David Wessel had an interesting column in the Wall Street Journal today. Populist. He's talking about this whole death tax thing, you know. And the House of Representatives voted 272 to 162 yesterday to wipe out the estate tax permanently. Permanently. No more estate tax. Now, you have to understand, why do we have an estate tax? The estate tax came about in large part because of the efforts of Teddy Roosevelt. And Teddy Roosevelt was responding to the populist revolt that came out of the collapse of the Republican Party, or the transformation of the Republican Party, in the 1870s. The Republican Party, up until roughly 1872, if you look at the platform, the party platform for the Republican Party in 1872, it was a very, very populist platform. I mean, it was just absolutely incredible, all the things that the Republican Party was saying. That, the, you know, clearly, I mean, this is just... Hang on just a second here. Finished. What's the deal here? Oh, REP. There we go. No, it's not finding it. Anyhow, the Republican Party was saying some pretty outrageous stuff, some very straightforward, very, very progressive things in 1874. I mean, this was part of it was the party of reform. It had started out as the party of reform. And I'm just, I know I've got it right here someplace. And here it is right here. I just have to share with you, you know, some of these pieces. This is from the actual platform. The actual platform, 1872, Republican Party. And I quote, "The nation's annual revenue, after paying current expenditures, pensions, and the interest on the public debt, should furnish a moderate balance for the reduction of the principal of the national debt." This is, of course, the debt left over from the Civil War. "And that revenue should be raised by duties upon importation," right, taxes on imported goods, "the details of which duties should be so adjusted as to aid in securing remunerative wages to labor and to promote the industry's prosperity and growth of the whole country." This was the Republican Party platform in 1872. They said, you know, pay down the debt until it's zero, pay off the national debt, and the way that you pay it off is you raise tariffs, and you raise those tariffs in selective and specific ways that will create jobs in the United States, that will promote industry's prosperity and growth of the whole country, to quote the Republican platform. The Republican platform in 1872 also said, and I quote, "The Republican Party is mindful of its obligations to the loyal women of America for their noble devotion to the cause of freedom. Their admission to wider fields of usefulness is viewed with satisfaction, and the honest demand of any class of citizens for additional rights should be treated with respectful consideration." In other words, that's their way of saying that they were in favor of women having the vote. This was in 1872, 50 years before women got the vote in the United States. From the Republican platform of 1872, and I quote, "The Republican Party proposes to respect the rights reserved by the people to themselves." That's like the right to privacy, the right to free speech, the right to show up and picket the president, whatever, to themselves as carefully as the powers delegated to them by the states and the federal government. It disapproves of the resort to unconstitutional laws for the purposes of removing evils by interference with rights not surrendered by the people to either the state or national government. The Republican Party of 1872 disapproves of the resort to unconstitutional laws for the purpose of removing evils. That's rather mind-boggling. The party noted that since it had first achieved national power with Lincoln's election, well, again, I'll quote to you from the Republican Party platform of 1872, during 11 years of supremacy, it has accepted with grand courage the solemn duties of the time. They're talking about their party. They've had the presidency since Lincoln. Republicans had, quote, emancipated 4 million of slaves and decreed the equal citizenship of all and established universal suffrage. Exhibiting unparalleled magnanimity, the Republican Party continually punished no man for political offenses, and tax revenues have been carefully collected and honestly applied. This is the Republican Party platform for the presidential campaign of 1872. The glorious record of the past is the party's best pledge for the future, the Republicans of 1872 wrote, blissfully unaware of how corrupt their party would become. They added, perhaps presciently, again quoting from the Republican Party platform of 1872, "We believe the people will not entrust the government to any party or combination of men composed chiefly of those who have resisted every step of such beneficent progress." Okay, so this was the group. This was the bunch. It was the Republican Party from 1856 to 1872 who were the party of reform, the party of balanced budgets, the party of making sure, well, for example, civil service. Here we have now, it's been getting a lot of press, the fact that Bolton and basically all these guys who showed up in 2000 down in Florida to help Bush steal the election, they're all getting elevated to high positions. They're all, you know, into civil service. Well, the Republicans of 1872 didn't think that anybody should be appointed to high office just because he was a party hack or the son of the Secretary of State. Like Michael Powell, you know. Instead, they wrote in their platform, quoting now from the Republican Party platform of 1872. They wrote in their platform, "Any system of civil service under which the subordinate positions of the government are considered rewards for mere party zeal is fatally demoralizing. And we, therefore, favor a reform of the system by laws which shall abolish the evils of patronage and make honesty, efficiency, and fidelity the essential qualifications for public positions." They went on to say, now get this, this is the Republican Party platform of 1872. This is what they ran on for President of the United States, Ulysses S. Grant. "We are opposed to further grants of public land to corporations and monopolies. No more free lunch for corporations." They were talking largely about the railroads when they said monopolies. "And demand that the national domain be set apart for free homes for the people." Opposed to further grants of public land to corporations and monopolies. No more free lunch for corporations. They were talking largely about the railroads when they said monopolies. "And demand that the national domain be set apart for free homes for the people. Give public lands that are public land to corporations and monopolies. No more free lunch for corporations." They were talking largely about the railroads when they said monopolies. "And demand that the national domain be set apart for free homes for the people. Give public lands that aren't being used to people." They were talking largely about the railroads when they said monopolies. "And demand that the national domain be set apart for free homes for the people. Give public lands that aren't being used to people, not to corporations. We are opposed to further grants of public land to corporations and monopolies." But in fact, in 1881, they would make monopolies illegal. with the Sherman Antitrust Act, just 9 years later. Is your mind boggled? Well, see, and what happened, what came out of this, was that by 1870, this was 1872, by, you know, 18, just after the Civil War, by 1878, by 1882, in those elections, the Republican Party, by that time, that's all it took. It only took about a decade. By that time, the Republicans, or whatever they called themselves, I mean, certainly the Republicans...
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Oh, what a crock! Oh, my goodness. And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. The death tax, the so-called death tax. It's really, I mean, it really is an estate tax, because the whole point of it is that what we wanted to say is that the United States has egalitarian ideals. We want there to be social mobility in this country. We want it to be possible for people to become comfortable, to become sort of wealthy. And what history tells us over and over and over again, I mean, over and over and over again, look at the history of any of the European countries. Look at the feudal history of Japan. Look at the history of the oligarchic history of South America. What history tells us over and over again is that when large concentrations of wealth, I'm talking about the equivalent in today's American dollars of billions of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars, when large amounts of wealth become accumulated into the hands of a single family, that family ends up multi-generationally becoming a dynasty. And if you have a handful, a few dozen dynastic families who control a really significant chunk of the wealth of the nation, half, two-thirds, three-quarters of the wealth of the nation, and those families all have aligned concerns, even though it may only represent a few thousand people, and that's the case right now in the United States, by the way, then their influence is disproportionate, and legislation and laws get passed to their benefit that are to our detriment. For example, George W. here in his first year in office, before 9/11, saying,
with a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Yeah. So we take $500 billion and we give it to the billionaires and the multimillionaires. And we did that year. And we did again the next year, and we did again the next year. And what happened? Did they run right out and say, hey, I got my tax break, I think I'm going to open a factory? No. They put it in Swiss francs. They put it in offshore accounts. They bought the debt of the U.S. government. I mean, they invested. That's why it's called the investor class. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't allow people to be wealthy in the United States, but I do think that it is time, and this is... Bill Gates Sr., Bill Gates' father, is running around saying this right now. He wrote a remarkable book with Chuck Collins called Wealth and Our Commonwealth. And if you go to buzzflash.com and click on my name, you'll find a review of it that I wrote 3 or 4 months ago, 5 months ago, something like that, that has a lot of quotes out of it. You'll probably find very useful. And it's all about the estate tax. And you have Bill Gates Sr. now traveling around the United States saying, we really need to have a discussion in this country about how much wealth we're going to allow to accumulate in the hands of a few thousand people. Because if you end up where 70, 80, 90% of all the wealth in the country is in the hands of 5, 10,000 people, then you no longer have a democracy. You have an oligarchy. You no longer have a true representative government if those people start getting politically active. You have a banana republic. And so the way that in their wisdom, in their substantial wisdom, the way that the people who first instituted the estate taxes came out of the progressive and populist movement, which came out of the collapse of the Republican Party in 1872, right? The way that they did this in the first decade of this century, of the last century, the 19-teens, when the estate tax was first passed and then gradually increased, was they said, hey, if when someone dies, they can pass along enough money that their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren, they're never going to have to work again as long as they live. But they are not going to be a dynasty. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So just because he wasn't really elected,
the Supreme Court got him in.
Just because that ballot count wasn't fair. Just because him and all his friends are millionaires.
Don't mean he don't care.
Don't mean he don't care.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Welcome back, my friend. No, it don't.
Don't care.
There you go. Oh, my. Here's some bad health news. By the way, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news, exposing the con in conservative 5 days a week, 3 hours a day, right here, right now. That's somebody else's slogan. Anyway, it's more than... Here's the. This is serious stuff. This is something to be concerned about. More than 70% of random duck and goose samples have tested positive for bird flu in Vietnam's southern Mekong Delta, but many farmers have refused to slaughter their flocks despite government orders. Officials said. Of more than 10,000, this is an AP Wire story from today's Wall Street Journal. Of more than 10,000 duck and goose samples gathered from poultry farms across 10 Mekong Delta provinces, 71% have tested positive this year. The virus can also be found in about 21% of chickens sampled. This is the virus that they are afraid if it jumps to humans, and it already has in 51 cases, well, it already has more than 51 humans have died now so far from this virus. They're afraid if this thing jumps into humans and gets out of Asia, the human contagious form, that we are going to have a repeat of at least something as bad as the Spanish flu of 1919, 1920, or perhaps even far worse. The test results suggest that more than 10 million out of nearly 20 million total birds should be slaughtered to try to eliminate the virus, says Nguyen Van Thanh, director of the Can Tho Regional Animal Health Center. This is in Vietnam. 10 out of 20 million. The problem is they're going to local farmers, and they're testing their birds, and they're finding 71% of the ducks, 21% of the chickens infected with this virus. And they're saying, if you kill your birds and bury them or burn them or whatever, burn them, I guess, to get rid of the virus, we will reimburse you. But the reimbursement is 10,000 dong. The dong is the Vietnamese currency, or about 32 cents. From 6,000 to 10,000 dong, 32 to 63 cents. But the market price of a bird is 20 to 30,000 dong. So they're giving them 5,000 dong, but if they sell the birds, they can make as much as 30,000 dong. So, I mean, you know, if you're a small farmer and this is like you're on the edge of life, what are you going to do? And we're talking about the difference between 32 cents and, you know, $1.10. And for that small margin, these farmers in Vietnam, these hundreds of thousands of farmers in Vietnam, are keeping these animals alive that are infected with this virus that could bring down the entire human race. And it's not that they're doing it maliciously. I would say that probably the vast majority of them are clueless. They don't even understand the significance of the problem. Many of them probably can't even read the newspaper to find out. So here we have a real crisis. A real crisis that could that threatens literally all of humanity. That could be solved, at least some part of it could be solved, with a very small amount of money. I mean, how many chickens are there in Vietnam for a dollar apiece? A million? 2 million? 10 million? 30 million? And what's the population of Vietnam? My recollection is the population of Vietnam is around 18 to 20 million people. I may be totally wrong on that, but I mean, my memory on that may be years old. But let's say that there's 20 million birds. In fact, here, this Wall Street Journal article, there are 20 million birds, total birds, chickens and ducks in Vietnam. $20 million is the cost of what, 8 minutes in Iraq? Why, where, I mean, here the real terrorist is a virus. Osama bin Laden, here we can't get a guy running around in a camel, a six foot two guy running around a camel with a dialysis machine. We can't find him. We're giving up on it's. But the real terrorist, the real problem, the real threat is right here in Vietnam. And you can bet the Vietnamese government, it would be saying to us or to the, I mean, if we don't want to use our money, go to the UN. Why doesn't our ambassador to the United Nations call an emergency session of the Security Council and say, we need to allocate $20 million. Let's make it $40 million. We will pay each one of these Vietnamese farmers $2 a bird. So instead of getting 30,000 dong in the marketplace, we'll give them 60,000 dong for their bird. So they'll have an incentive to slaughter these birds so that the bird flu won't jump out. We're talking chump change. We're talking the amount of money that most of with regard to the United Nations, that, you know, most of the diplomats probably run up in monthly parking tickets in New York City. Where is the leadership? Well, George Bush is going to, you know, what, throw out a ball for a ball game, or he's going to meet with sports heroes, or he's going to show up, you know, as an action figure with the troops. And they're going to vote down over $1 billion in aid for the troops. But at least, you know, you can understand the Republicans rationalizing that by saying, the Republicans saying that in their mind, the troops are not all that important, and $1 billion is a lot of money, and you've got to have tax cuts for the rich. I mean, after all, you're going to have, you know, $500 billion in tax cuts. That money has to come from somewhere, right?
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
By the way, if you do the math on that, $550 billion to create 1 million jobs means we're spending $550,000 for each job created. I still don't understand to this day. It's been 3 years since George Bush said that, and I have not once, and he said it over and over and over again, and nobody on the news ever said, George Bush is proposing to spend $550,000 per job to create jobs. I'll tell you, if he just went out and found 1 million people who were you know, living below the poverty line, or even average middle class, you know, just people, you know, with a mortgage and just the normal debt stuff, you know, just average people, and gave each one of them $550,000, you'd see a boom in the economy. Sure you would, because they'd buy things. But not that I'm recommending that. I mean, it's an absurd recommendation. It's almost as absurd as Bush's original idea. But here he is. He's got $550 billion in his first year, his first tax cut for billionaires and millionaires, for the Walton family, for Paris Hilton and her buddies. Plenty of money for them. Well, we don't have a billion for the troops. Sorry. Shot that down yesterday. And we don't even have a few million to deal with the possibility that a virus may come here that could wipe out, you know, could kill, like, what, 1 in 10, 1 in 5, 1 in 3? I mean, so far, the people who have been infected with this virus, more than half of them have died. Now, you know, what happens when viruses like this get out into the population at large is that they tend to lose virulence because the people that they, you know, when they kill people really aggressively, then people die so quickly that they don't transmit the virus. And so the weaker viruses where people don't die, but they just get sick, but they keep showing up at work and at school and stuff, that virus then gets passed along. This is why when the Spanish flu epidemic happened in 1919, 1920, it started on the east coast of the United States as the soldiers were returning from Europe, although the actual flu probably began in Asia, which is the incubator for most flus, carried by birds. But in any case, it started on the East Coast, and it was very virulent. It was killing a lot of people, and by the time it got to the Rocky Mountains, it was down to the point where it was killing very few people. By the time it got to the West Coast, it was killing almost nobody. It's fascinating to look at the epidemiology of the great flu pandemic of the 1920s. So, you know, odds are something like that will happen, although that was before jet air transportation. And now you've got the possibility, as we saw with SARS, you know, where you had this virus in Hong Kong, and the next day it's in Montreal. So where is the leadership? Where are the Democrats on this? Where is the leadership on this? Why doesn't somebody do something? I am going to call my member of Congress on this. 1-877, by the way, if you want to call your member of Congress, 1-877-SOB-USOB is the number for Congress. And you can just ask for, you can ask for the president's office, the vice president's office, this is the Capitol switchboard. Any senator, any member of Congress, any member of the House of Representatives, right there. By the way, our phone number, 1-866-889-8894, TomHartman.com if you want to drop into the chat room. Beer Giant says it won't buy rice from states that grow GM crops. Now, this is interesting. Actually, you know, I'll just give this to you very quickly. Anheuser-Busch, this from the Associated Press, Anheuser-Busch, the nation's number one buyer of rice, as well as its largest brewer, because they brew rice into things, says it won't buy rice from Missouri if genetically modified drug-making crops are allowed to be grown in that state. There's this company, Ventria Biosciences, that wants to grow 200 acres of rice engineered to produce human proteins that can be used to make drugs. Lactoferrin is one of them. And Anheuser-Busch now. I mean, when it was the Greens saying, hey, look out, these things are going to jump from plant to plant. There is this thing called cross-pollination. Do you really want the genes for the production of a drug in the rice that's in that was made into the mixture of grains that was made into your beer? You really want that? A lot of people are going to say no. Well, when it was just Greens, when it was just environmentally, when it was just the organic farmers getting upset, didn't quite make the national press. But when Anheuser-Busch says it, now this already happened in California, by the way. This company is moving from Sacramento to Missouri because California was giving them a hard time, apparently. That's my read on this. And Scott Dieter, president of Sacramento-based Ventria, called Anheuser-Busch's threat, quote, totally irresponsible, end quote, and said fears of contamination are overblown. He cited Ventria's plans to use, quote, a totally closed system of production, end quote, with a plant that pollinates itself and is separated geographically from any other crop. See, this is the kind of stuff that Michael Crichton turns into movies about dinosaurs. People who believe that you can create a biological organism and absolutely 100% control it forever. I'm sorry. In 1995, the USDA has approved, since 1995, the USDA has approved more than 300 biofarming plantings around the country, although most are just small outdoor plots of less than an acre each. The issue has already roiled California's $500 million a year rice industry. Last year, California regulators denied Ventria's application to grow commercial quantities of rice with human genes after rice growers said they feared international customers would refuse to buy conventionally grown crops out of contamination fears. So, meanwhile, farmers in southeast Missouri, where nearly all of the state's $100 million rice crop is grown, have presented Missouri's agriculture director a petition with 175 signatures opposing the plans. Missouri is the sixth largest rice-producing state in the United States. Despite the concerns, the Missouri Farm Bureau has continued to support Ventria. Why would they do that? I'm telling you, it's the same thing as the Chamber of Commerce. You know, we get our health insurance through the Chamber of Commerce in Vermont, and they present themselves as like, we're here to protect the little guy. We're here for the small business. But they dance to the tune of the big multinational corporations. It's just that simple. And my guess would be the same is the case with the Missouri Farm Bureau. Continue to support Ventria, which recently announced it was moving from Sacramento, California to Northwest Missouri State University to be the anchor tenant of a new center for plant-made pharmaceuticals. Yeah. That'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But the one that I really wanted to share with you, the story from today's news that I thought was really fascinating. How much longer are we going to be able to basically live off the backs of our slaves in China? You've heard me say before, we didn't end slavery in the United States, we merely exported it. How much longer are we going to be able to do that? Now, the Chinese are actually revolting. They're rising up in China, saying, no, we don't want any more contamination of our lands. I sense a slave revolt. Logan in New York City on the line. Hey, Logan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I was just wondering, first of all, why it's not illegal to have products that are made with child labor, just in general. And
it's not illegal because the lawmakers who make the laws get their money from the corporations who are using that child labor. So they make it illegal in the United States, so we don't have to look at our at the slaves or at child labor, but they don't make it illegal outside the United States.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of international law, I mean, is it the same way in Europe? I mean, are Europeans also guilty of this pandering to multinationals?
Sure, sure. Yeah, I lived in Germany for a year. You walk in any German store and you can buy stuff from China, from Malaysia, from Vietnam, from all over. Sure.
And what about their priorities in terms of this SARS epidemic? Are they a little bit ahead of the game than us?
Who's the they you're talking about?
The Europeans.
Oh, I frankly don't know. You're talking about the bird flu thing, not SARS. Yeah, this bird flu is the H2N5 virus, as I recall. I don't know. I mean, there was this little tiny story in today's Wall Street Journal, and this, I think, is a huge story. It should have been a headline on page one. And, hopefully it won't become one day, but we need some leadership. We need some leadership on it.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program. That's me, by the way. Be careful. The Republicans will use that argument to cut down more trees, says Lakota 4. It's the bird flu. We can't have bird flu. It's carried by birds. Can't have birds. They nest in trees. We need to call our friends in the logging industry. Help us out here. Yeah, that'll solve the problem. And this is something that's carried by ducks and geese, and I now have a back porch covered with ducks and geese. Oh, my. Well, see, this is enlightened self-interest. The folks in the chat room, we're trying to figure out, is it the H2N1 virus, the H2N5 virus? We'll find out. Anyway, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Sean in Indianapolis on the line. Hey, Sean, haven't talked to you in a while. How are you?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I've been around. I just haven't called.
Yeah, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to tell you that the reason why Bush is not taking this avian bird flu very seriously is because, remember, you're dealing with people that you're dealing with a person that is trying to convince the world that the world's going to end any day now anyway, and that's, you know, that's all of our
faith. Oh, you know, you're right. The four horsemen of the apocalypse, one of them is plague.
And to even install this in our brains even more, as if we really need that, they even came out with a new TV show now called Revelations.
Yeah.
So that, you know, we get it piped through the mainstream media.
Well, in the Left Behind books, Tim LaHaye's books and Jerry, what's his name, the Left Behind books are just incredibly huge sellers. I actually read part of the first one when it first came out because it was such a phenomenon. They're outselling the Da Vinci Code. I mean, they're outselling everything. They just don't show up on bestseller lists because they're considered Christian books rather than mainstream books. And it's like there is just this huge constituency of people who think, ah, bird flu in Vietnam, H5N1. Thank you, Paul. Paul, good on you. Anyhow, it's a real phenomenon, Sean. And maybe you've got something there. Maybe it's grim to think that might be why they would be doing it. But
hey,
maybe.
You know what? And I'm disabled, and they look at us as like potential converts. Like we're spiritually, you know, we're spiritually vulnerable. So I get hit on by these people and always have all my life,
yeah.
You know, thinking that I'm going to cross over to the other side of the day now because I'm this poor person in a wheelchair and I need a friend, you know, and they always go to hit on us. And I just, you know, I just get so irritated by it.
Yeah.
Plus, on our cable system, there are seven Christian far right.
It is incredibly profitable, Sean. When Pat Robertson sold his network, he sold it for $1 billion cash. They are free from having to pay taxes. The rest of us are paying for the infrastructure that they're using. They got over $1 billion in subsidies in the last year. I mean, just in the last year, $1 billion of our tax dollars given to them with these faith-based initiatives of Bush. This is something that wasn't going on before, and brand new, and it wasn't even reported. Sean, I gotta move along. It's the end of the show. Thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. I do appreciate it. Always good to hear from you. And keep the faith there, Sean. Keep up the good work. Keep spreading the word. We have to wake up America, my friends. We have a country to bring back. I think it's much more important that we be planning for the future of our children and our grandchildren than that we be planning for the future of the rapture, with or without the rapture. That's, you know, where it is.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.